Good day, all, and welcome to our launch of DS&I Deconstructs. We want to thank you for joining us as we bring together our distinguished guests to discuss topics related to the efficacy of land trusts and community organizing, and the application of racial equity at its center. Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, DS&I, formed in 1984, and is a community-based planning and organizing group in the Dudley area of Roxbury, Boston, that manages the largest urban community land trust in the country. This includes homes, community gardens and parks, and playgrounds. DS&I is a member organization with a 35-member board made up of community residents, area businesses, nonprofits, and religious institutions who help to guide the work of DS&I, which focuses primarily on community economic development, leadership development, and collaboration, and the development of the land trust. In this podcast series, we will engage our guests and listeners to question, analyze, and think towards the futurity of our community and city together. Hello, everyone. Welcome again to DS&I Deconstructs. This is our sixth episode, and we are going to be talking about reparations. Are you ready for this conversation, John?
I am. I'm really excited for the folks that are in the room and joining us today.
Absolutely. As I was speaking to John earlier, I said, you know, so many people in Boston and actually across the nation are having these conversations, and it's really important information. So today we are joined by two brilliant guests from Boston. The first of our guests is from King Boston, Dr. April Khadija Innes, MD, MSc, is the Director of Community Engaged Research. She has a background as a pediatrician and mixed methods researcher and brings to King Boston a passion for health equity and social justice. Dr. Innes received a master's in health services research from the University of Michigan as a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation clinical scholar, a doctor of medicine degree from the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and a BA in urban studies from Brown University. She completed her residency in pediatrics at Tufts Children's Hospital in Boston, Mass. Welcome, April. Thank you so much for joining us. We are also joined by Mr. Eric Estevez, Executive Director of the Lenny Zakim Fund. Eric Estevez is a philanthropist, educator, artist, community advocate, and technologist. Executive Director Eric Estevez previously served as Director of Social Innovation Fund at the Boston Foundation. He also served as a consultant for Root Cause, Harvard Business School's Interpersonal Skills Development Lab, and the Boston Impact Initiative. In 2019, he co-directed Lead Boston as an experiential professional development program focused on socially responsible leadership based at YW Boston. Eric received both his undergraduate degree in business administration and his graduate degree in information systems from Northeastern University. A resident of Roxbury, he spent the early part of his career in educational technology, including leadership roles at Lesley University and Boston Public Schools. Eric gets excited about the usual things: trivia, hip hop, and I know him from Project Hip Hop, that's right. Kayaking, genealogy, politics, social justice, photography, poetry, sweet potato pie, and to-do lists. I love it. Eric, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us in this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, you know, I just read these bios off, but I know both of you to be such interesting, brilliant people. So I want to invite you to share some other things about yourself as we are in these conversations. Sound good?
Sounds great. Thank you, Farai. Thank you, John. It's such an honor to be with you today and be with your listeners. I guess I'll just add, too, that there's, you know, other than the research side and the clinical side, there's a program that I started called EEK MD, It stands for Empowering Every Kid for Maximum Development. And it's a mini medical school for elementary school age children. And the objective is to socialize them to what it means to be a healthy and well adult, start building some early foundational health literacy skills, and also to expose them to health careers. We were running the program out of Roxbury Community College. We had done some partnership work with the Children's Museum, and a number of schools throughout the city and greater Boston area. So, you know, that's also part of the perspective that I bring to my work at King Boston, really trying to educate folks and socialize our community to some of these equity issues that are being hashed out as we speak. So I'm really grateful to be in that role and to serve in that role at King Boston in that capacity.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm sure that many of our listeners are like, what? Where's this program? Is this program still running? Can I get my young person into it?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. So visit our website, www.ekmd.com. We have a podcast that we're going to release by the end of the summer. Really, it's a medical mystery podcast for kids. So really excited about that. So if you want to learn more and get on our mailing list, definitely go to ekmd.com.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Eric, would you like to share any other projects or things that you're working on that you'd like the listeners to know about?
Sure. Two things I'll share is I really like trivia. So I started a trivia business called Hella Black Trivia that was an in-person event that shifted and pivoted to virtual. But we have a card game that people can enjoy at home and learn a little bit about Black history, both past and present, at hellablacktrivia.com. But also, I'm the lead organizer of TEDx Roxbury, and it's a TEDx branded event that I'm hoping to bring to the Roxbury community, hopefully by the end of this year.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that again. Brilliant folks, but also interesting folks, folks doing really impactful work here in Boston, and we want to keep learning more about these two. But let's just jump right into the conversation about reparations, which is why we're all here. I'd like to start by just asking, you know, to frame and give some context to our conversation. Can you all please, just from your understanding, if you're deeply involved in the work, or just what you may know about reparations, what are reparations? And what are the current kind of platforms or approaches to reparations? And who are the leaders right now in reparations?
Sure. Happy to tackle that. So reparations is part of the racial equity work that we do here at King Boston, particularly around racial equity in economics, for example. And the definition that we use is the one that's been provided by NCOBRA that has been advocating for reparations for Black people for decades. The definition that they put forward is that it is a process. And I'll have to emphasize that it's a process because a lot of people, when they hear the word reparations, they think, oh, this is a one-time issuing a check. And, you know, checks are, of course, an important part of the conversation. I don't want to discount that. But reparations are really a process that involves steps to really redress this crime against humanity that's been committed against Black folks in this country, starting with slavery and then continuing on with the legacy of Jim Crow, and of course, the ongoing legacy of discrimination that we're living in today. So again, reparations is a process and not a one-time act. And it's the process of repairing, healing, and restoring a people who were injured due to their group identity in violation of their fundamental human rights by a government, corporation, institution, or individual. So that's a sound definition that we offer up for reparations.
I really appreciate you saying that because I, you know, as someone who is certainly interested in reparations, feels compelled to keep moving the conversation forward. I didn't even understand that that's what it was. In my mind, you know, I'm thinking a couple of things. One, money. These are some of the things that you're hearing in general. Eric, any thoughts to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the redressing of harms, but also the redistribution of wealth. So for me, my vantage point being in philanthropy is based on capitalism. So, but capitalism is based on the backs of Black people who are enslaved in America. So it's how are we changing the dynamic of who's making decisions about where money goes, who's receiving that money, how much is being invested in people and communities to repair them, to allow them to thrive, versus being invested in an endowment that continues to grow. In what ways are we really taking a critical lens to where the money's going, who's managing the money, who's making decisions about where money is being distributed?
Can I just quickly piggyback off of what Eric Sure. said? Because what he said about the community piece is so critical, because reparations can really take two forms when we think about the material aspect of it. So there's direct cash payments, and then there are community level benefits that entail targeted investments in things like education, housing, creating opportunities for folks to build wealth, things like that. So really, again, it's not just a one-time issuing of a check, but really to kind of build a community ecosystem of healing and repair. So it's much more comprehensive and broad-based than I think a lot of people might recognize.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. And thank you for adding that piece in, Eric. So important, this idea of building wealth, particularly as Black Americans or Black folks in general across the diaspora. But who are the leaders in Boston? Do either of you know who's leading this work?
I can say that we stand on the shoulders of a long legacy of those fighting for Black freedom, Black liberation. But most recently here in the city of Boston, I can very proudly point to the NAACP under the leadership of Tanisha Sullivan. I can point to the New Democracy Coalition under the leadership of Reverend Kevin Peterson. I can point to community organizers like Aziza Robinson Goodnight, who was very involved in the effort to rename Faneuil Hall. I can point to Yvette Modestine, who's also been very active in this space. So we stand on the shoulders of giants, both past and present, who have been doing work in this space for some time.
Thank you for naming those folks. I know a couple of them, and I know that they've been organizers in this city for years. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense and is apropos to lift up those names.
Sure. I want to take off on this where you were about healing and repair, especially within the context of community. So lots of things, you know, this idea of reparations really being a place where we can start to really focus on doing that work. What's the evolution of your thinking on that? Like, how did you get to that as you're starting to think about reparations? And how did you arrive there? Mm-hmm. You know, this whole idea of precursor to the conversation we talked about, quantifying harm and sort of healing from that, and then thinking about it from the perspective of philanthropy and the redistribution of wealth. You know, so how did we and how did you all in your work arrive to that?
For me, personally, it started when I was a senior in high school. I went to Boston Latin Academy right off of Warren Street. And my aunt gave me a wonderful gift. She gave me Randall Robinson's book, What America Owes Black People. And I remember reading that thinking, oh, gee, this sounds great. This sounds exactly like what, you know, Black people deserve for uncompensated labor and ongoing discrimination in this country. But gee, that feels a long way off. Maybe my grandchildren will see reparations. But today, just seeing the uptick in activity that's taken place, particularly after the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, where the country really started to enter this new era of racial reckoning, we've seen proposals for reparations crop up in, you know, a dozen or so cities and states across the country. We've seen new movement around H.R. 40 at the federal level. And by the way, H.R. 40 is the federal bill that would establish a commission to take up the issue of reparations. So just to be clear, it's not awarding reparations yet, it's establishing a commission to study the issue and make some recommendations. So this is an exciting time to be doing this kind of work because of all the movement that's been happening of late. And because of these pockets of activity around the country, we're now seeing what's possible. And that's almost having a domino effect where other people are kind of paying attention and imagining the possibilities for what a healing and repair program could really look like for our Black communities, not just in Boston, but across the country.
And yeah, so for me, I mean, my thinking has been informed just by my kind of upbringing. You know, I grew up in South Carolina in the Low Country area, and specifically Charleston and Edisto Island. So Charleston was, you know, essentially the major slave port in the country. Edisto Island is one of the sea islands and the Gullah Geechee people. So I'm Gullah Geechee, and those roots and that heritage has always remained. So I can trace back my lineage, you know, 6, 7, 8 generations, but it stops in the 1840s or 30s. So it doesn't go further than that because, you know, we inherited that Hutchinson last name and we don't know anything about those who came before Jim Hutchinson, for example. So for me, it's always been kind of an awareness of, you know, enslaved people who have been resilient, but, you know, were done wrong also. You know, that's always been kind of present in my mind. So I've always kind of been steeped in community, and even, you know, moving to Boston 25 years ago now, always have had a kind of a deep community focus, but also a connection across generations. So I've learned a lot from, you know, some of my mentors have passed away, but some are still here, but really learning about, you know, the history of my hometown and the history of Boston's Black history has really helped inform kind of the ways in which Black people have been done wrong here in South Carolina and across the country. And, you know, I think more recently, as Dr. Innes said, you know, there are some creative ideas coming up around the country about ways to redress those harms, whether it's, you know, direct cash payments or just different programs and incentives.
Well, speaking of redressing and repair, it doesn't happen without several different systems involved. And one of the biggest ones is this political one, right? So within the context of the political and cultural movements, whether of past and present, how does reparations fit into that?
Happy to kick that off. Well, I'll tell you that ever since the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, there's been efforts to seek reparations for, again, the uncompensated labor of enslaved peoples in this country. For example, I look at the first group of freedmen who tried to secure hold the government accountable to the 40 acres and a mule promise. Don't quote me on this, but even before the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, I want to say that Belinda Sutton, who was a woman enslaved by the royal family, this is in Massachusetts, She made a petition for her unpaid labor, for her reparations, and she won that petition.
Yes.
But from what I understand, through some very clever legal maneuvers, she saw very little, if any, of those reparations she was ultimately awarded in the court. So we stand on the shoulders of figures like that. And I can tell you, for example, about Queen Mother Audley Moore, who is largely considered the founder of the modern reparations movement here in this country. I would tell your listeners, check out William Darity Jr. and Kirsten Mullen's book called From Here to Equality. In the first two chapters of that book, they give a very detailed and elegant history of the pursuit for reparations in this country. And I'll say specific to reparations for Black folks, because a lot of people think reparations feels like such a big thing. How could we ever do that? But the reality is this country has done reparations before, and a lot of people may not know that. The slaveholders.
Come on with it.
Okay. The slaveholders received reparations.
Yes, they did.
So right before the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, Lincoln said, okay, you know, we'll pay you, I think it was $300 at the time, which comes out to about 8,000 USD today. He said, for every slave that you free, I'll pay you in today's dollars, $8,000 in return for your loyalty to the Union. So slaveholders got reparations. And we know, of course, our Native and Indigenous brothers and sisters received some form of reparations. Those efforts, of course, are inadequate. There's room to go there, but they at least have started to receive something. Same story for our Japanese American brothers and sisters who received some compensation for when they were held in internment camps during World War II. So reparations are not something new or, you know, unique to this country. It has been done before, and history teaches us that. In this moment that we're in now, we see that reparations can happen again for for us?
The precedent is certainly there. I guess for me, it's the documented rationale for it also. So, you know, the documented building of wealth, you know, at all of our higher ed institutions, for example. So, you know, Massachusetts and Boston in particular have a ton of higher ed institutions. Harvard has more recently kind of documented their slave past and ties to the past. For instance, Brown University has kind of a well-documented process and project that they did to really document all of their kind of wealth that was accumulated because of slavery. So I think there's certainly a lot of precedents there in terms of the rationale for why reparations make sense. But even more locally, you know, there are a ton of companies, especially insurance companies, that benefited tremendously because of the insurance policies on enslaved people that were then paid out, many of which were based here because this was a major shipping port as well, enslaved port. If you think about redlining in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and how the accumulated wealth of Black people was diminished and stifled because their inability to access federal home loans and also just home ownership in general. So there's certainly a lot of direct ties to the racial wealth gap that is based in political decisions and systems and policies and laws that were intentionally put in place.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that you framed it in that way, because it's almost, some folks talk about white affirmative action. Many of those things were even, and you know, beyond, say, some of the political systems or some of the institutions, down to individuals, what they received as a result of, right? I can also speak to, I just learned that Haiti has just paid off France. Like, so France was receiving a cash benefit for all of the enslaved people that they had, right? And then when that whole political system turned over, they were being paid for that. And it's not until like this year or last year that that's just gotten paid off recently. I really appreciate that you all have lifted up the things that you said. I want to ask another question along these lines, especially Dr. Innes. Please, April, come with it. What does the research or data look like as it relates to some of what we're talking about right now? Because you've done this vast amount of work. It's the harm report?
Yes. And I'll just preface what I'm about to say with the fact that the facts are on our side. Frankly, looking back over the centuries, the case for reparations, at least in my mind, is undeniable. It's an open shut case. But I will add, though, that despite that, a careful documentation of the harms, particularly specific to a level of government. So, for example, whether it's at the level of municipal government, like we're doing here in Boston, state government, federal government, there needs to be a documentation of the harms in those specific ways that those in government, those in policy have been complicit in these harms. So it's almost like in building what we call a harm report, you're almost making almost like a legal case. At the end of that report, for folks to look at that last page and feel with little to no doubt that, you know, Black folks are owed for the unpaid labor of their ancestors and the legacy of discrimination that's been carried forward despite the Emancipation Proclamation. There's a debt that is owed that has to be paid that's impacting people today. So what we've been doing as part of our contribution for the work at the city level here in Boston is our harm report, where we've sought to document where possible, where the city or the state of Massachusetts has been complicit in these harms. What I will say about our harm report is that it serves a couple of key purposes. First, it gets folks on the same page with the facts, because a lot of people say, and I understand, even as a researcher, I get it. Like, people say, do we really need another report? Like, we all know all the messed up things that have been happening to Black folks over the centuries. Like, we know. And while that is true to some extent, it's still important to get people on the same page with, you know, working with the same set of facts. That's one. And then two, because conversations around reparations are seeing sort of a renaissance, so to speak, it's also important to equip folks with the basics around, like, what are reparations? What could repair and healing look like in our communities? So a harm report forms a basis for casting a vision around that. So for our harm report, we partnered with our local colleges and universities and also with community. But I'll specifically say, for example, I brought in 5 researchers, 3 from UMass Boston in their PhD programs, one of whom is actually a Rhodes Scholar. She's since moved on and it continues to do incredible things. And we also got on board 2 master's level students from Northeastern in the Capstone program under the guidance of Professor Ted Landsmark, who has been a huge friend, mentor, colleague in this work. So we pulled together this group of students who were handpicked based on previous scholarship, areas of interest and expertise. But while that was happening, King Boston has been holding meetings of the New Boston Coalition, for example, where we've been hearing directly from community about the issues that are most pressing to them, the things that are high priority and of great importance to them. And based on that, taken together with some of the things that have been done in the past around reparations, we came up with this report. And this report covers 7 injury areas. And an injury area is just a specific sector or area where people have been harmed. So the 7 injury areas covered in our harm report are income and wealth, housing, education, transportation, health, culture and symbols, and the criminal legal system. And I also want to be clear, though, that this harm report that we've put together for the city of Boston is not comprehensive, because if we sat down to document all the ways that Black people have been harmed and discriminated against, that's a years-long effort that could probably make a couple of volumes, if not more. But really, we looked for those watershed moments or policies that created the landscape of inequity that we inhabit today. So that's what my students did. They did a wonderful job. And what we're doing as part of this harm report, particularly around engaging community in this process, is we've been holding a series of community conversations. Some are for the general public, but then some are just for Bostonians who identify as Black. Because as traditional teachings around reparations holds, the government can't decide what repair looks like. Mm. King Boston can't even decide what repair looks like. No body or institution can decide that. Only the people that were harmed have to determine what redress looks like. So again, we've been holding these community conversations and continuing to hear from Black Bostonians about, you know, sections of this report that they might want to see lifted up in a repair program, things like that. So we're really privileged to have been able to do this work around the harm report and make what we hope is a meaningful contribution to the effort here in the city of Boston.
I'm really glad that you, King Boston, and this coalition is doing this work. It's so important, and it's important to get out, you know, clarify at the root, at the foundation, what led to, what is. You spoke something a moment ago, and it made me think of something I've heard. It's Neely Fuller Jr. One thing that you never ask for is an apology. You don't ask for respect. Mm. You don't ask for love. Mm-hmm. You don't ask for these things. It's really interesting to hear that, one, you're starting with community, and that those who have been harmed are the ones who get to do the asking, that you understand that full and clear.
I'm thinking about South Carolina. And I mean, the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter, right? April 1861. I'm thinking that, you know, so this is continuum from when the slaves were bought to the first shots being fired to then this civil war that was really, as we know, that his genesis was in slavery. And thinking that, you know, we always frame this many times as this slavery as this particularly Southern sort of institution, and, you know, sometimes forget the role that the North has played, right? And so we talk about racism in Boston, and lots of people still see Boston as this racist city. You know, and when I'm outside of Boston, people will talk about, how do you live in Boston? You're Black and you live in Boston. It's this racist city. So I'm thinking about slavery and all the ties in the North and the role that the North played in some of the context you provided, April. I'm just wondering, like, given Boston history, A, and then given the racial wealth gap report, which we all saw, what's the connection between the racial wellcap report and this reparative conversation that we're having and reparations from the perspective of philanthropy and also from, you know, the research and the thinking that you've done on it?
Yeah, I think for me, there's a direct connection. You know, people who are not in Boston think of Boston and really kind of zero in on the 70s and busing without really talking about how there was similar busing issues going on in Hartford and Milwaukee and Buffalo and Rochester and Chicago, other northern cities as well. And then, you know, even slavery, the frequency wasn't happening as much here. It was being financed up here while it was happening down south. So there's always that direct connection. You know, for me, in terms of philanthropy, there are many private and family foundations whose wealth and their endowments was based on the accumulation of wealth from companies that were directly benefited from either monopolies or industry or probably enslaved labor as well. You know, the many companies have bought other companies over the years and have changed names. Even Bank of America is one example that has accumulated many companies, but some of those prior companies from 100 years ago had direct ties to financing slavery as well. So some of those institutions don't exist. Some do exist, but are in a different form and shape and different name. So I think, you know, there's certainly kind of direct connections there. And then also for me in philanthropy, as an example, you know, there are different areas where ideas can come out. You know, for me, my background in philanthropy was specifically in education. So, you know, one thing that has happened locally, there's this tuition-free community college program, which is an idea that's come up in other places where it essentially subsidizes community college or the cost of an associate's degree for those who are low income, which primarily in the greater Boston area are Black and Latino people. So while it may not necessarily be directly considered reparations, it is a way of directly drawing attention and funding and investing in young people who historically were, you know, disadvantaged and under-resourced as a way to help them develop their careers and ideally not just obtain jobs, but obtain careers and earn livable wages to really start to chip away at that wealth gap.
I just want to quickly piggyback off of something that Eric said earlier, which is critical. Yes, Massachusetts was a major port. And not only that, but we were the first colony to legalize slavery in 1641. And a lot of people may not know, too, that when we look at some other policies like Plessy versus Ferguson and the whole doctrine around separate but equal, that originated here in Massachusetts. I really appreciate the point you made, Eric, about how, you know, a lot of northern states, they have this reputation as being, you know, hotbeds of abolition and freedom and liberty and all of that. But the data tells us otherwise. Like, for example, if we look at the gaps in home ownership between people of color and white people, Massachusetts, I think, ranks in the top seven as far as how big that gap is. Mm-hmm. A bunch of northern states are in the top 20. So the North has its own reckoning that needs to happen. And that's the moment that we're in now. If we look at Evanston, for example, Evanston, Illinois, and the great work that's been happening around housing reparations under the leadership of Robin Rue Simmons, who's a former alderman, who's since kind of moved on in another capacity with reparations there in Evanston. They're awarding grants of $25,000 to folks that have been, that can document that they've been impacted by policies that displaced Black families to the Fifth Ward in Evanston, Illinois. So if you're able to kind of document that you were affected by that, you're now eligible for this $25,000 to either buy a home, repair a current home, or even pass it on to an heir, for example. So the North is kind of having a moment right now.
You talked about that home ownership gap in Massachusetts and Boston. Mm-hmm. And I know there's been some research done in people looking at redlining, which is, I think, extremely important as we think about that home ownership gap. You talked about the density of disadvantage.
Yes.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that more?
Goodness, yeah. So this density of disadvantage is how I like to think about it. And, you know, it really started with those original homeowners loan corporation maps from 1933 that were put out by the Federal Housing Administration. And what those maps did, so they mapped, I think, 236 U.S. cities and carve them up based on how desirable they were or how risky they were in terms of awarding mortgages. As you can imagine, communities of color, immigrant communities, were all areas where high concentration of those folks lived were marked as the least desirable. And those folks didn't have the access to those mortgages that were backed by the federal government. So that set things into motion in a significant way. And here we are 90 years later and seeing not just persistent home ownership gaps, particularly as we looked at those areas that were marked in red, but also when we look at other areas of disadvantage, when we look at health, we look at education, we look at involvement with the criminal legal system, for example, those same areas that were redlined keep lighting up. So again, it's this density of disadvantage, and those are the kinds of harms that we're looking to repair from in pursuing reparations here in the city and in the state of Massachusetts as well.
You know, I want to shift a little bit. It builds on where we were going in the conversation already. You both have given one or two examples, but thinking about some of the arguments about reparations, have the government or other entities paid reparations before? And if so, to whom, and what was the mechanism to kind of draw those out? You know, you spoke of Evanston. That's happening now, yeah. Right? They're figuring that out now. When I think of, for instance, the GI Bill, that served some people, that gave some kind of resources to some folks, but not others. Are there any things that we know of where reparations to Black people have happened or occurred? I mean, I know that you spoke a little bit about Roxbury Community College, for instance, and having this capacity for those who are lower income folks to go and get certain things. So that's a type of reparations. But anything else that either one of you know of or can speak to?
The only thing I would add to that is one caveat to kind of avoid as we talk about reparations. And it's this notion that run-of-the-mill public policy can somehow be reparations. But for a repair program to be real, frankly, it has to be targeted to the group that suffered harm. Like, for example, I've heard people say, well, you know, why don't we just make all public transportation free? And that's reparations. And that, you know, broadens our tent because it affects and brings in everybody. And that's great. You know, I would love for public transportation to be free for everybody, but that's not reparations. Yeah. So I just wanted to point that out too, that, you know, run-of-the-mill public policy that kind of blankets everyone isn't reparations.
Boston, at least at one point, right, we were talking about Boston being a majority minority city. Are we still there?
It was like 51% at one point.
At one point, yeah. So I'm thinking about how do we calculate? Because sometimes this is the conversation, right? How do we calculate how much people are owed?
Oh, goodness.
And who's owed? And, you know, given the changing, quote unquote, Black population of Boston, which is Caribbean and Haitian, and how do we do that? That's a hot button issue. There's some controversial takes there. I was just wondering what your thoughts are. You guys thinking about that?
I don't have an answer for how to calculate. I know it'll be very challenging. I think Boston has one of the higher Black immigrant populations in the country. Maybe it's close to a third of the Black population. So it also depends on how you're defining the group. Are we talking about just enslaved people who were direct descendants of enslaved Africans in America or not?
Yeah, big question.
Right, there's some criteria there that we have to work out, right?
Right, that's exactly right. Eric just highlighted some really key points that we do have to consider as a city. Because if we look at, for example, the Black population in certain cities compared to Boston, ours is among the most diverse Black populations in the country. Honestly, you know, we have folks from all across the diaspora. But I would say that the role of these commissions, whether it's the one that the Boston City Council is grappling with as we speak, or if we're looking at HR 40, that's one of the things that the commission is tasked with, is working with community to determine what those criteria are. And to an earlier point that was made, the answer to that question also depends on precisely what you're looking to repair from. So for example, if you're looking to repair from the unpaid debts that were accumulated during slavery, well, that's a specific population. Those are the American descendants of enslaved peoples here in the United States. If you're looking to repair, for example, from a specific housing harm, like what's happening in Evanston, Illinois, there may be folks who have roots in Haiti, for example, or in other parts of the Caribbean that may have been harmed as part of that displacement that happened in the mid 20th century. So it depends on what you're repairing from. And there are, of course, camps that have taken up sort of very entrenched positions on sort of both sides of that. And it's really up to the commission to work in partnership with community to determine who's eligible, because it is a big question. It's an important question that's hanging out there. But just to piggyback on the dollar amount. So Darity, William Darity, who of course is an economist, and his book From Here to Equality, I keep highlighting that book because it is just that good and there's just so much in it. He put the number close to $13 trillion in terms of what's owed at the federal level. And he sees that debt being paid over 10 years. 10 years is probably ambitious, but I mean, we've seen hundreds of billions of dollars being issued out over the pandemic, things like that. So suddenly, $1 trillion doesn't sound like this impossible amount. But depending on the economists you ask and how they arrive at the calculation, that number could be slightly different. But suffice it to say, the debt that is owed is huge and at the federal level would likely have to be paid over generations.
That's interesting. When you're thinking about the harm, and you talked about it, you framed it in terms of trauma. It's at all levels.
Yeah.
Can we have a reparative program that touches all of that? Because we think about people go and they talk and they heal from a certain kind of trauma. This healing conversation is very different, okay, in that sense. So just sort of thinking, as we build this out, as the commissions think about this, as philanthropists think about this, the academics, community folks, what should we be focusing on? Because this trauma is historical. It's very deep. It's all different levels. So where are we focusing in terms of that?
When we counsel someone who's been traumatized, we're not counseling trauma in this broad sense. Like there's a specific trauma. Maybe it's trauma from physical abuse or sexual assault or something like that. It's specific. And I guess that leads me to just add some really quick remarks about the role of local reparation efforts versus federal ones. So the stuff that's happening locally is small. Right? Like $25,000, for example, per homeowner is great, but it's nowhere near the debt that's owed. And really only the federal government has the resources to pay out full reparations and institute full repair in a lot of those injury areas I listed earlier. Only the federal government can touch income and wealth, housing, education, transportation, health, so on and so on. But the local efforts still do play a role. First, the local efforts, by definition, they do have to be targeted because they are small. So in order to make an impact, there has to be some focus there. But what the local efforts do is they keep the conversation around HR 40 buzzing, which is important. And then secondly, local efforts can lay the infrastructure that we'll need to distribute resources once we pass HR 40 and that commission is made and they've made recommendations and we're now implementing those recommendations. Like, you know, there has to be a body on the ground in all these different cities and states to distribute funds and oversee all of that. So the local efforts, even though they are small and very focused, do play a role in the bigger picture. And depending on who you ask, like there are some people that think the local efforts are a waste of time and a distraction from HR 40. But there are those who belong to the camp that I'm in that say, no, they actually help. And again, keep the conversation around the federal repair effort going.
Really appreciate that. I want to hop in here because you lifted up something that is near and dear to my heart, which is this psychological trauma, right? Mm-hmm. The racialization, enslavement, there are these systemic things. There are, you know, you gave these seven areas and you did speak very eloquently about the institutions or government. These folks who can come in with their repair will be a financial repair. Their repair might be some kind of institutionalized repair. But there is a repair, a healing, right? The healing John lifted up earlier that happens at the psychological level. So when you think about the internalization of all of the harm, what can you as a doctor as someone who is engaged with folks, where does that fit into this conversation? Because a lot of the conversation is about dollars and cents, right? A lot of the conversation is about specific housing. A lot of the conversation is about external and enabling factors that allow people to grow and prosper and, as Eric said, build wealth. But what about the other harm, the deeper harms, actually, that impact people's capacity to even engage with those other pieces?
Yeah.
Can either of you or both of you speak a little bit about that? Has that been your experience? And do you feel like that should be a part of the conversation?
I mean, I think mental health as a whole has been a kind of a broader and more widely discussed topic in the Black community in the last few years. And I think that that is paired with kind of the country, also kind of the nationwide reckoning around race and equity. So, you know, I think kind of that psychological trauma is a big piece. And then, you know, a comedian will tell you Black people will get money and spend it on the wrong things. And then someone who is a bigot may say the exact same thing. So how do you kind of tease out the nuance between, you know, what different people may want to do and the ways in which people spend their money? And then what that means when we critique people and critique the ways people want to do things differently. So, you know, I think there's a whole lot of layers in that, but I certainly should be a kind of part of a comprehensive strategy because, you know, even with the conversation about reparations, I don't think everyone will be pleased. I don't think that's possible. If it comes to a final resolution, there'll be plenty of people who will be pleased with the outcome and plenty of people who will be not pleased with the outcome. So there won't necessarily be a happy medium, but at least my hope is that it will be comprehensive and expansive and rigorous in the way that it tries to address some of the prior wrongs, whether it's related to policy or just historical systemic inequities.
Yes, the mental health piece is so critical. And then also, how do I say this or explain this? Like, the American story and where Black people sit in that story has and continues to have a psychological impact. And that's where this injury area and conversation around culture and symbols really becomes so important. Like the Monuments Lab, which is a nonprofit out of Philadelphia, they recently undertook a very big analysis of, I believe, 46,000 monuments from across the country. And they documented who was being memorialized, what the symbols stood for, and all of that. And they found that of the 50 most memorialized people in this country, half of them owned slaves. Mm-hmm. Only 3 of them were Black people. And even if we look at Massachusetts, for example, of the 3,000 plus monuments logged here in the state, I believe 7 are noted as commemorating Black people. And those are just monuments. I mean, we're not even talking about things like street names, the schools and buildings that, you know, these different spaces are named for. We're not even taking that into account. So we're talking about, like, you know, being from Boston, we always talk about going down Dudley. You know, I'm going down Dudley to mm-hmm. pick up this, or I'm going to meet somebody down Dudley. mm-hmm. And it's so funny because Bostonians, we say down Dudley. Mm-hmm. We never just say I'm going to Dudley, we're going down Dudley. But from what I understand, Dudley was someone who owned slaves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and now we've seen that renamed to Nubian Square to celebrate the heritage of the folks that live and work in that space for the most part. So that has an impact on the psyche, and that's something that a reparations program could and absolutely should address. And I'll just quickly plug King Boston's Embrace Memorial that's coming to the Boston Common in January, the largest memorial to anti-racism since 2020, I believe. And the first memorial to come to the Boston Common in 120 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So again, we're looking for narrative shift, narrative change to impact people's psyches and spirits in a positive way.
Yeah. So I think I want to thank you both for really making this a rich and really meaningful and mindful conversation. I think we have to probably do it again in some level. But, you know, we at the SNI really think about land use and how it's deployed. And historically, it's about people of color being dispossessed in terms of land and and this being a crucial conversation for us from that perspective, right? You know, there are many different parts to wealth building, and we work closely with philanthropic organizations. We work with other partners like King Boston to really sort of accentuate that kind of work in and around land. And thinking, what else would you sort of leave all listeners with? You're saying that this would be a takeaway from this conversation. What would you leave them with?
For me, I would say to try to be more discerning and just think about how even current public policy and ideas have kind of overlapping intersections. And because sometimes policies prey on the poor or vulnerable populations unintentionally or intentionally, and it takes community organizing and activism to push back on those policies. So I think, you know, so that current policy doesn't have to be redressed in the harms, their harms redressed later, being proactively now pushing back on them, I think goes a long way.
The thing that I would conclude with is that repair is possible. But I also recognize that for a lot of people, I'm just trying to keep it real for myself. I'm just thinking like a lot of people may not have the capacity to engage or attend meetings or, you know, show up at the state house and advocate. And those of us that have more capacity should do those things. You know, call and email your city council members and ask them to advocate for this proposal that's before them right now to establish a commission here in the city of Boston. Reach out to your state legislators for what Massachusetts could be doing around that commission for truth, justice, and reconciliation around race. Reach out to your federal government representatives around H.R. 40, for example. But for those of us that may not have the capacity for all of that because you're busy trying to put food on the table, pick your kids up from school and all of that life stuff, vote. Your vote matters. Your vote counts. I know it's very easy to get disillusioned and not want to bother in the political process because it could feel pointless sometimes, to be honest. But I would say for those of us that have capacity, do what you can. And those of us that have less capacity, do what you can, even if it means just casting a ballot in your local election. Like everybody thinks about the election for president or maybe the election for mayor, but these other positions are just as important and frankly may even be more important. So vote and get involved to the extent that you can because repair is possible. We're in a moment where we can really see this thing through. So let's do that.
Love it. Love it.
Thank you so much.
Let's do that. Thank you, Dr. Khadija Enes from King Boston, Mr. Eric Estevez from the Lenny Zakim Fund. Thank you so much for both of you being here and all that you shared in this conversation. Looking forward to inviting you back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.